Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Well, the Media Project's underway, and it's going to be an important show because HBR has weighed in. HBR, the Harvard Business Review. Dr. Alan Shartok is here, who walks in such circles, Professor Emeritus.
Not quite, but around
CEO
there.
CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist, journalism professor. How do you do?
Hello.
Hello, hello, and I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany. We welcome you all to the program and invite you to join the conversation by sending us email, media@wamc.org. But we're getting ahead of it because we haven't had conversation yet. HBR, the Harvard Business Review, says that really we people in the legacy media are just whining that we shouldn't worry, that things really should be okay. Right? Isn't that what they said?
That is what she said. This is an article by Sarah Green. And Rex shared it with us earlier in the week before the program. And I think my response was something like, oh, God, don't you just want to slap her?
The headline is Publishers Stop Crying Over Spilled Ink. And her basic premise is that actually everything's going just fine in the media.
Yeah, you silly people. Look at all the people interested in the news.
There's, and all the people who've been fired.
She doesn't look at that. No, she doesn't look at that.
And all the empty desks and all the rest of it. You know, sometimes these elitist people, you know, the Harvard crowd, can sort of spit down the hill in an inappropriate way. I don't like it when it happens.
Her point is that a lot of media companies are doing very well.
Is it that, Rex, or is it she doesn't deal with the business at all? She's just saying that there's a lot more people using media
mm-hmm.
than ever before, which is not news to us. It's
right.
The frustration.
We always talk about that here.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. It's the frustration that there are all these apparent interested consumers, and we don't have the business model to tap into them.
No, we can't. We fail to monetize.
Exactly.
It's because of the aggregation, because the internet enables aggregation, because you can be gathering all the stuff from everybody that is put out there digitally, and a person can get that access to that without paying for the journalism that produces it.
Well, but of course, that is changing to some degree. I mean, we've been talking for years now about paywalls and the development of paywalls, and we've watched it go back and forth between those who think if you give it out for free, more people will come, you can sell advertising that way, and then the other side, which does seem to be winning now, which is we've got to monetize it. Somebody's got to pay for all of this, and we're going
to
do it.
This article to me was more in the vein of Jay Rosen, who is a New York University professor who I have knocked numerous times because he separates the media world into two slices. One are the tribe, the dinosaurs, the print people, and the rest are all the good people who are going to save us with digital. And that is bogus, as this is, because we are not separate. We are the same. Those of us who are dinosaurs. I started on, you know, typewriters. I don't advocate for typewriters. You advance to the next method, which is a computer, and now we advance into digital media, and it's all exciting. Video and tweeting and all of that is exciting to us. It is not as if we are a barrier to it. So her complaint here is that David Carr, who's a wonderful writer about the media for the New York Times, simply frames everything he writes about in terms of print. And I hate this story.
Well, you know,
I can't believe it got into print.
I'll tell you how it did get into print. That's the only academic in the room. I know all about these journals. And people need to have a new thesis in order to publish. And what happens is you look around and say, well, nobody said this. I'll say this. No, I don't want to say that that's what happened here. specifically, because I don't like lawsuits. But sometimes that's what does happen.
You have to publish, yes.
You have to publish. And what's interesting is it tends to come around and around and around. In other words, there's really nothing new under the sun, but somebody will put a new name on it to get into one of these journals. You see it in education, for example, all the time.
Well, this is an opinion piece where she does, it's not really peer reviewed, but she dismisses, if you did have to have a peer review, she dismisses what would be an argument against it in a single sentence by saying, the challenge is finding new business strategies that make money off our ever less satiable appetite for content.
Oh, duh.
Duh. Exactly.
Well, it's easy for her sitting up there at Harvard, you know.
Well, I want to do a little tangent here, which I usually yell at you for doing, Alan.
No, I never do.
This article reminded me again of how much feelings of the public about the media are framed not by what the media does, but what's written about or how we are portrayed in the other media. So, example, movies that portray journalists always as stupid and or dishonest.
Like an absence of malice.
Good example. Yeah. So this week we saw that again with a comedian appearing on some actual newscast. This is Will Ferrell, who's coming out with a sequel to his it's wonderful, you know, it's a great comedy, The Anchorman. Anchorman 2 is coming out. And so he goes on a North Dakota news station as part of the regular, you know, newscast at, I guess, 6 o'clock. And he's telling jokes all through, and, you know, the actual newscasters are laughing and guffawing. What kind of image does that project?
I take the other side on this, not surprisingly, Rosemary. I think, okay, come on now, folks, let's loosen up. People are smart. They know it's Will Ferrell. He comes on, one of the most famous faces in the country. He comes on, you know, a little bit of looseness here is called for, Rosemary.
I think it suggests that at KXM MB in Bismarck, North Dakota, they take their responsibility not too terribly seriously.
Come on. They are so pompous. I appeared on the news for way over 20 years on local, local news. What'd you say?
Nothing.
What'd you say?
You said these news guys are so pompous. And I said,
I was the exception to the rule.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And, you know, I mean, I think they take themselves too seriously. They read what the 23-year-old kid wrote on the piece of paper.
It's make-believe. It's make-believe when you put Will Ferrell in reading the news. I don't let my students even put fake names in. You can say anonymous source, but you don't say someone will call David.
Well, Rosemary, you think the people who are watching this thing didn't know what was going on? These are the same local news stories that put all kinds of CRAP on.
On public radio. We can't speak it, yes?
No, it's not. It's not what you think it is.
Uh-huh.
The CRAP is the Consortium for the Republican Approach to Politics.
Yes.
I think this is a TV station that said we are a joke. And they said it very literally.
Well, we disagree, and I applaud them for doing it.
Anyway, speaking of applause, we have a letter from a listener. I do this all the time, don't I? Speaking of our print fixation, I'm sorry. A listener who, other than applause, wants to say something else about the media. The writer Kathleen, I don't know where Kathleen is coming from because she sent mail to media@wmc.org. With respect to the anniversary of the Newtown tragedy, her concern is, as she says, the media communicates with words and words are powerful. I think we know that. But she is concerned that the terms we use to describe the cowards who shoot or bomb children in schools, unarmed moviegoers, and athletes in marathon runs. Why are they, in our news stories, called shooters, terrorists, or killers? Why not call them what they are? Cowards. So her point is that in writing about this, she says, I respectfully ask that the media use your power to help the whole world understand that terrorist shooters and bombers are not the holders of real power in our world, and the people who try to fight injustice through the courts, through teaching, through healing, are the powerful. Use those words. Any point?
Well, I want to ask you, as the editor of a fine newspaper, how you react to that, Rex. I mean, after all, you know, you have to make a decision. If a reporter came to you and said, the cowards who blew up, you know, the thing, what your reaction to that would be?
Not too favorable. I'm reminded of the front page, the wood, as it's called in tabloids, the big word on the front page of a tabloid on 9/12/2001.
Yes, I remember this.
And the New York Post, the headline was simply, Bastards. And, you know, I can understand the New York Post tries to reflect the working class ethos of the city it serves. So you can say, well, it is what it is. It is the New York Post. But it doesn't seem to me that that's appropriate for us if your goal is to describe what happened. And what happens is somebody came in and shot children in a school in Newtown, Connecticut. That person is a shooter. And it is making a value judgment to call that person a coward.
Her point, this was, I commend this letter writer. It really made me think. I read it and thought about it. And I agree with Rex, but I wanted to know why I thought that. And here's the thing. Her point is not that it's inaccurate to call them killers, but that those are words of power. You know, if you're reading this, it makes you want to go and be one of them. Go be a terrorist. Whereas coward, it is pejorative, and so you shy away from it. It's similar to people who say that when we write about suicide, we have to couch it in terms that doesn't make it sound like a noble or heroic act. The media can't do that. You know, we just cannot do it. We are not in the business of making roles or value judgments. We have to just present it cold without description.
Well, that's a sensible thing, except we don't do that.
We don't.
We in fact couch our stories one way or another, just the way we compose them, the way we
even the words, Alan. She's right about that. Insurgent versus freedom fighter.
Sure.
In the American Revolution, were the colonists insurgents, terrorists? If you apply
the
words
Israelis,
that
when they up the
Israelis,
King David,
anybody in the Middle East, we do this, or the way we describe sexual attacks. You know, the specific words are different,
and sometimes we actually change them. So, for example, as you appropriately used the Afghanistan example, you know, when they were on our side, we used one word, and when they were our enemy, they were the other word.
So the writer is exactly right that words have power, and that the media needs to think about how we employ them and when. It's difficult to do it. It's not something that
but
writing
we do.
One letter.
I mean, Rex writes the headline on the Times Union, doesn't he think about context? Don't you do that when you've been an editor or when you're writing, Rosemary?
Yes, and still I am, after 40 years, still constantly surprised by how words can turn on me. I remember once in Virginia we wrote about a song that has a title, but it is known as the Black National Anthem. And so in our headline, written, by the way, by a black reporter, so there was no intent whatever, we called it the so-called Black National Anthem. And we were inundated with mail saying that, how dare you call it that? It is the black, you know, because so-called does have a certain sarcastic nuance to it. Never thought. So words do have meaning that people read closely, and it's really hard to figure it out.
And yes, one of the things people don't understand about headlines, too, is just that they're very difficult to write because you have a limited amount of space, a certain font size. And so oftentimes the shorthand that will fit does not precisely match the aspirations of the reader for precision. But by the way, I do want to correct Alan. I don't write headlines. I don't usually have that job. There
but you have, haven't
that.
You, Rex?
I have on occasion written headlines, yes.
Will the witness answer yes or no? Have you written a headline? The answer is you have. And I don't need to be corrected, therefore. Rex, I got to ask you.
Yes.
And Rosemary, I have to ask you a question, and that is, don't you think, though, that there are people who are stakeholders in anything? So you might get any ethnic person. You might get anybody who is black or white or Jewish or Catholic or something, and who often read into these words pejorative intent, which was never meant.
Yes.
Happens all the time. And an interesting story this week that we should comment on is the release of the 911 tapes in Newtown. And again, here are extremely powerful words. And the state officials tried to keep those tapes because they thought it would be hurtful to the people who have survived. And
hurtful to me.
That. Well, it's hard to hear. It's like the 911 New York tapes when people were calling, you know, their loved ones.
Which were never released because it's under different state law. The actual words of the people in the towers that were hit have never been released yet.
In mass they have not. Some of the actual recordings have been released because individuals haven't given them out. Mm-hmm. So again, thinking about this, I strongly believe those tapes need to be public and we should have them. And yet, when reading them today, how do I describe to the public why it's important that they have these words?
That's exactly the question I was going to ask you, Rosemary. Yep. So answer your own question. Since you posited that you think it's important that we did it, I don't, because there's always a balance. Now I want to know the justification for doing it.
Okay, I'd make a couple of points, and then Rex, please, you know, bolster me on this. One is that the media cannot write for victims and survivors. they should just not read the paper on this stuff or look in the news. Like, you know, me. It's yeah. They're going to be hurt. They have been hurt in the worst way possible. So, of course, anybody who writes about it is going to add to that. And you stay away from the news media. Keep these people away from the news. We don't write for them. That's the sad truth.
Now, who do you write for again?
For the public. And that's the vast majority of people, not those directly affected.
What if the vast majority of the people didn't want to read that too hurtful to everybody?
How would you know? But it's...
No, but let's assume you could know. Let's assume...
Well, that's my second point, is that many people who are not directly related also think it's wrong. It's an invasion of privacy. But the stuff is first historical. Mm-hmm. I hate that we're still waiting on the Kennedy material. That should be out so we can look at it for historical reasons. And number two is, this is the end of life, and that is important and deserves to be recorded. It doesn't matter whether it's painful or joyful. It's historically important.
I think you're exactly right. If we are going to believe what now has become sort of a catchphrase that's widely used, the rough first draft of history, the journalism is, you can't hope
very
to
rough.
Do as well in recording that history if you don't have access to all the material. You don't have to have an opportunity to give people a sense of what's really going on unless you have access to as much raw data as possible. So openness is always the best first chance. I really like what Rosemary said about the media cannot write for victims and survivors. I often hear from people objecting to coverage, saying, what if that were your kid? What if this was your family?
I would hate it.
Of course, I would too.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It would be horrible.
That is not the standard we can apply.
Right.
In fact, we need to walk away from that kind of standard.
Just for my own personal edification, because I think the issue is it's a matter of balance. I think Rosemary's point about the Kennedy material, because so much time has elapsed, makes an awful lot of sense. Everybody's gone. You know, Jackie's gone. The president is gone. The kids are gone. One kid is gone. You know, the other, of course, is the ambassador to Japan. And so the question to you guys is, you will admit that this is a matter of balance. It's not right or wrong.
What are we balancing? What are
You're balancing, you know, the pain that inflicts on people. You're balancing the fact that when you let this kind of stuff out, and I, by the way, don't quite agree with you as to the potential for motivation. I think the motivation is what we call red meat in the business. In other words, people say, oh, golly, as Rex always say, golly gee whiz, Martha, look at what this guy said as his child is being killed or whatever. I mean, I think it's terrible.
I do want to read that stuff. That's why we read novels and short stories. It's drama. Of course I want to read it. But these tapes do more than that. You saw that in the reportage today by the Associated Press, where they looked at calls made by Newtown officials to the state police, Connecticut State Police, and the calls went unanswered, except they did more reporting, and the state police didn't answer because they were already en route. And I think there's a story there on how the dispatchers were handling it. They were getting all these calls. It's quite heroic. Mm-hmm. They were saying, get everybody we have out there. You can hear that in the background. The tapes are really interesting. Isn't that reason enough to get them?
Well, on one side of the balance equation, it is. You didn't hear Alan, A-L-A-N, you didn't hear Alan saying, you know, I don't understand your argument. I understand both of your arguments.
Right.
But I also understand that there are different motivations on the part of editors in terms of selling it. We saw a similar story this week from MSNBC. You know, somebody may want to talk about that.
You think
that.
That's selling? I don't know. But, you know, if the goal is to sell newspapers, you know, that's a wonderful byproduct of great storytelling. But
it may not be a byproduct. It might be the main motivation.
But there's a great value in giving people a sense of the world beyond their own experience. This, as Rosemary says, it's why we read novels. There is something to be said for even that terrible experience that every young reporter has, where you have to go knock on the door of a family when a kid has been killed or something has happened. You go knock on the door and you say, tell me about
Joe. How do you feel about your kid being killed?
And, you know, you hate to do it, and everybody says,
tell me about how you feel about your kid.
You're terrible.
You are memorializing the people who died.
Well, that's one question.
And what you give your readers, then, is a sense of how the world operates that the readers themselves don't have to go through. You're giving people better understanding of what it is to be human. And that's a great role of journalism, beyond just telling them what's going on in town board meetings and planning boards and so on.
And so it is not a case, as you often say, of golly gee whiz, Martha,
no.
look what look what this guy said about it.
Well, Golly Martha is a fine thing. I think it's great for
I like those too.
Yeah, sure. That's fine. But that's, you know, Golly Martha could be what a space explorer discovers out on the edge of the universe. That can be a Golly Martha story. But I think there's a real value, even against, if it's a balancing, Alan, I generally balance, in, as Rosemary would, in favor of openness. But you do make judgments all the time about saying, you know, we're not going to do this. We're not going to take advantage of a child, for example, who doesn't know what they're doing. In the code of ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists, one of the major tenets is minimize harm to the extent
that you can. The most compelling part of the tapes, I think, was the teacher shot in the foot. She's bleeding on the floor. She's got all the kids on the floor, and the door's not locked. They're afraid to send somebody or to get up herself and go unlock the door. She's speaking completely calmly and rationally, and the dispatcher's trying to help her figure out what to do. Oh, my God. It's just such an amazing story, and that needs to come out. I want to tell those kinds of stories.
One of the reasons that kind of thing needs to come out is because sometimes there are things to be learned from this so that it's not replicated another time.
That's true.
For example, lock the door.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. Anyway, so again, to join the conversation, media@wamc.org. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, and Rex Smith here, and we invite your comments. By the way, what Alan was referring to earlier is the kind of inflammatory remarks that sometimes force people out of journalism. In this case, it was the MSNBC host, Martin Bashir. Is that how you pronounce it? Bashir?
Bashir.
He resigned after making negative remarks about Sarah Palin, the former Alaska.
And we are talking about really negative remarks.
Yeah, it was very tough stuff. He talked about her long diseased mind, and he said,
a world-class idiot.
Yes, indeed.
But I think it got worse than that. I don't want to do this on this family radio station, but I think it did get pretty specific.
He told the story of Thomas Thistlewood, a former overseer at a plantation who described in diaries how he dealt with wayward slaves by, in one case, having another slave defecate in the mouth of the miscreant, is the AP story here. So he said, quote, when Ms. Palin invokes slavery, she doesn't just prove her rank ignorance, she confirms that if anyone truly qualifies for a dose of discipline from Thomas Thistlewood, then she would be the outstanding candidate. He apologized.
That's gross.
Yeah, isn't that quite outrageous?
So the real question is, should he have resigned or been fired for having said that about Palin?
Same effect. I mean, he's been punished, and he deserved it. You know, this is a scary story to me because now I'm having my little bit of play in radio. This is the first time I've done that working at WAMC. And sometimes when you push, when you're outrageous, we try to do it on purpose because it's, as you call it, Alan, good radio. So I can almost see that he's almost aiming for this, and he just steps over the line, which he didn't see until afterward.
Well, I have a thesis, which is that when the right-wingers, the Rush Limbaughs and the other guys, there's always a guy coming up behind them who can outright wing you. So your approach has to be, you have to keep the other guys back. I think that goes on the left sometimes, too. And I think that's what happened in this case. He was in love with his, his rhetoric. That at least it seemed that way to me. And he wasn't going to take any back step to anybody else. And it's interesting because somehow the right wingers don't seem to be punished in the same way that the people on the left.
Well,
are.
Rush Limbaugh certainly still has quite the following. It's not as though he has lost any. While denouncing the mainstream media, he is, of course, the most significant voice in mainstream media. It's kind of an amazing notion, but he manages to walk that fine line, I guess you'd say. Maybe we should say all credit to Rush for being able to do that, huh?
Maybe we shouldn't.
Finally, in the realm of just reminding you that people are out there trying to work very hard to bring you truth, very difficult situation going on for Bloomberg News in China. Chinese authorities have conducted unannounced inspections of their bureau, but this comes after a controversy about an investigative series that had been prepared by Bloomberg News that has not published, that seems to have been spiked. There's an old term, spikes. Nobody
talk
has spikes.
About print publication.
We used to have spikes in newsrooms. In fact,
and on the volleyball court.
Yeah, well, that too. An old reporter. I walked through the newsroom as a young reporter, and I was whistling, and this old cops reporter said, "If you don't stop that, I'm going to throw this spike at you." And I said, "What?" And apparently, there's a superstition that whistling in the newsroom is bad luck. And this guy threatened everybody
that.
Had a spike on their desk where you'd put a print copy.
Yeah, sure.
Bloomberg, anyway, has spiked a story. Apparently, there is significant pressure on Bloomberg, and a Bloomberg reporter has been excluded from opportunity to cover things. Just stands to show you how hard it is sometimes to maintain coverage on foreign soil.
In this case, I feel for Mike Forsythe, the reporter on the project, who quit Bloomberg, apparently over the story.
What were his choices? Spiked. And Bloomberg, by the way, not that it's relevant to the story, has announced that even though he owns a cable series, he doesn't watch television.
Right. All right, that's all for this week. Hope you join us again next week on The Media Project.
It's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ding-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery.